Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Uganda, far from only the leaders speaking, there is going to be some action coming up, you know, guided by us that would be propelled, you know, by the kind of conditions that people live under in this country.
A new political pressure group, the People's Front for Transition, announces its official formation in Uganda.
We are a worker-led organization as the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa. When our members say it's enough, then it's enough. But the strike continues until they say it's enough.
The National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, or NUMSA, embarks on an indefinite strike action.
I have been a victim of the anti-corruption commission in this country under the previous regime. I went to report some Chinese national sometime last year. Before I could even sit in my vehicle, that Chinese called me to say you are leaving the ACC. ACC reporting an informant to a suspect.
And an independent parliamentarian is calling on Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema to intensify the fight against corruption. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Uganda, the People's Front for Transition, a new political pressure group, has been launched. Leaders of the group include former presidential candidates Dr. Chisa Besigye and Patrick Oboi Amuriat, as well as Kampala Lord Mayor Erias Lukwago, civil society groups and human rights defenders. The group says its core objective is to ensure the next general election is fair, transparent and credible, that it says will lead to a transition from the administration of longtime President Yoweri Museveni. But critics say the People's Front for Transition is unlikely to succeed. They argue that it appears to be just another group of failed politicians who were unable to defeat President Museveni during previous elections but want to stay relevant. Patrick Oboi Amuriat is a leading member of the group and a former presidential candidate of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, in the last election. He tells me that the newly launched People's Front for Transition gives Ugandans a violence-free opportunity to pressure the Museveni government to lose the next general election and to allow for a new administration with fresh ideas to resolve the challenges facing the country.
The People's Forum for Transition is an arrangement that brings together political actors, political pressure groups, political parties, civil society organizations, the religious, eminent people, all fighting towards bringing change in our country and running a transitional government through a transitional period that would then usher in a new beginning for our country in terms of democracy, the rule of law, and respect for human rights. So this was launched today in Kampala.
But Patrick, what is the objective of this group? Because this is not the only political pressure or civil society group in Uganda.
The objective of this group is to, first of all, mobilize the people of Uganda and cause them to act to bring down the dictatorship that has persisted for 36 years. And this is going to be done through non-violent means, in other words, through civic action or defiance based on conscientization of the people and also organizing them for action, the end result being action. And then when everything is done in respect to bringing change in leadership, a transitional government will then be formed, and this transitional government will be responsible for doing everything that is possible to return the country to a true democracy.
Supporters of the NRM are suggesting that the top leadership of this new pressure group comprises failed politicians who were unable to defeat President Museveni at the post. They are saying you couldn't defeat him at the ballot box and now you want to form a pressure group, create instability, so to speak.
failing or winning in this country is subjective. It depends on where you are coming from. And I think that the NRM would herald themselves and the electoral process in this country and claim it's a perfect process, that everything is okay with the election. It's run in accordance with the law and rights are respected. But I think that they really need to look back at what happens in each and every election that we've been through, and particularly in this election of 2021, where I was a candidate. What we experienced was a military operation, and we didn't have the space even to campaign. You know, wherever we set foot, we were harassed, we were beaten. And you know, for anybody to even begin to chest thump thinking that this was an election is really losing the meaning of a truly free, fair, and transparent election.
But Patrick, realistically, what do you think are the prospects of this group in actualizing your objective?
The prospects are very high, so to say. This is something that we have been at for quite a long time now. You know, the country being misrun today, you find that human rights are violated, you know, with impunity. The quality of life of our people has been degraded to a level that most of them live below the poverty line and have been reduced to beggars. The problems of the young people, for example, have hardly been addressed, and the rate of unemployment is through the roof. And premised on that, therefore, we believe that the Ugandan people will rise up by themselves with our leadership to make a statement to the people who rule this country, or misrule us for that matter. And so really, people are living under very, very, very difficult conditions, and therefore, since they are living these conditions, it's something that we believe will be able to precipitate a reaction from among the population of Uganda. Far from only the leaders speaking, there is going to be some action coming up, you know, guided by us, that would be propelled, you know, by the kind of conditions that people live under in this country.
Patrick Oboye Amuriat is a leading member of the group and former presidential candidate of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, or NUMSA, says its members will continue with the ongoing strike action until their demands are met. The workers embarked on the strike after talks with employment organizations on a three-year pay agreement reached a stalemate. Industry experts say construction and mining automotive companies with workers from NUMSA will see a significant disruption. The workers are demanding an 8% pay raise, including a couple that will be 2% above the inflation rate for the next 2 years. They also want the increment to be backdated to July. Experts say the strike comes at a time when South Africa's economy is reeling from the impact of the global coronavirus pandemic. Pakimile Klubi Majola is the spokesperson for the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa. She tells me that a 4% pay increase proposed by employer organizations is unacceptable and an affront to workers.
Well, the main reason for us is the fact that we've deadlocked with employers in the engineering sector. And on top of that, we're the most unequal society in the world. But executives in this country earn very, very well, whilst ordinary workers earn peanuts. And it was out of just sheer anger and frustration, really, that our members decided that they've had enough. And they took a decision to embark on a national strike because we feel that the employers, the bosses in the engineering sector are selfish. They don't want to give anything back to workers. Even after workers last year sacrificed increases in order to ensure that the sector could perform better, could survive COVID, they're not making any kind of meaningful offer that would inspire workers to return to work.
But some people are suggesting in South Africa that if you are in negotiations and you embark on an indefinite strike, basically it's a sign of bad faith. Instead of negotiating for them to address the concerns that you have. How do you respond to such criticism?
Workers in South Africa, when they go on strike, they sacrifice for that strike. Every day they go on strike, it's no work, no pay. That's the policy that gets implemented. So do you understand that for a person to take a decision to sacrifice their wages in order to make a point to the bosses, it shows you that this person has reached a point of no return. And the question that you're asking me, I would ask you to pose that to the bosses in the engineering sector. They, besides the fact that our government doled out millions to support them during COVID, on top of the fact that our government supported them financially, workers last year agreed not to take an increase for the sake of the sector. And instead of responding in kind, instead of coming back to us this year, understanding the sacrifices that we've made, they have the audacity to tell workers that they're going to give them a 4.4% increase. You must know this 4.4% increase is for people who are very, very low earners. Some of them are earning as little as 20 rand an hour. And what does a 4.4% increase mean for someone who's earning 20 rand an hour? It's nothing. You may as well have said 0%. So workers are fed up, and they've got every right to exercise their democratic rights to strike. They're withholding their labor, and they feel that the only way that they can convince these people to take them seriously is to hit them where it's going to hurt, and that's going to be on their profit margin.
Some people are also suggesting that if you want to say engineering jobs or businesses in South Africa, then you have to work with the companies because due to the global coronavirus pandemic, economies have been hit hard, businesses have been hit hard. So in order to save the job and to work and get paid, then you have to work with them to come out of the economic slump. How do you respond to that?
Nobody understands recession like ordinary workers and their families. The employers in this sector, many of them don't even bother to pay what is the minimum rate, which is the acceptable rate. They flout the regulations. So again, I'm going to say to you that you should pose that question to them. We are not being irresponsible. And it, frankly, it's unfair that the burden of saving the economy must always be felt or carried by ordinary workers and their families. At what point does the industry take responsibility for the economy? At what point does the industry itself care enough about the economy to sit around the table and offer workers meaningful increases instead of reaping rampant profits during COVID at the expense of workers? So we reject that suggestion with the contempt that it deserves.
How sustainable is this indefinite strike? Since you have a policy of no work, no pay, how sustainable, how long do you think your members are willing to withstand this no pay after embarking on this strike?
As I said, it's indefinite until our members tell us to stop. We are a worker-led organization as the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa. When our members say it's enough, then it's enough. But the strike continues until they say it's enough.
Pakamile Khlubi Majola is the spokesperson for the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Zambia, an independent parliamentarian is calling on President Hakainde Hichilema to intensify the fight against corruption in the Southern African country. At a recent news conference, parliamentarian Munir Zulu says the president should ensure public officials accused of corruption step aside to allow for a thorough, independent and transparent audit of all public institutions. Mr. Zulu says he is displeased that public officials accused of financial malfeasance from the previous administration remain in their positions. Mr. Zulu argues that if allowed to remain, the officials could thwart the president's anti-corruption crusade by destroying evidence needed in possible future prosecution. Parliamentarian Munir Zulu tells me that President Hichilema has the support of Zambians to move quickly in the fight against corruption to restore confidence in public institutions.
I made reference to the Henry Kapoko case.
where the judgment in part read that the current secretary to cabinet, Dr. Simon Mitty, should have been arrested for that judgment, all right? Now, if the new Don administration is saying they're here to fight corruption, then why should you keep a character like Dr. Simon Mitty as secretary to cabinet?
Yeah, but Mr. Zulu, evidence is the name of the game. No.
Look, I've told people, it is not my nature to be malicious. What is evidence? If we make reference to John Hatchard Munandulo, he said evidence is all legal means exclusive of mere arguments that tend to prove an allegation or a matter of fact is evidence. A judgment is there. So what more evidence do you want? If the previous regime ignored the judgment, should the new Don government equally ignore that judgment? The answer is no. Or maybe are they telling us that what was bad in PF should be treated as being good under the UPND government? PF ignored it. Why should UPND ignore that judgment?
You said some individuals that work with the former ruling party were known criminals and they don't deserve any position in the new Don government. Who are you referring to, and do you have evidence against them? Because at this point, they are mere allegations of corruption.
I was very specific in my address. I said, Honorable Kapala does not deserve to be in the new Don government. The National Airports Council Managing Director had written the Engineering Institution of Zambia to investigate him for professional misconduct and was found to be guilty. The reports are there. I challenge ECZ to deny. They've kept quiet.
Have you engaged the government after President Hakainde Hichilema made a promise that he was going to ensure zero tolerance for corruption in his administration? Have you engaged them or taken him up on his promise?
You see, the challenge is that Dr. Mitty is still calling the shots. I remember being summoned by the police because Dr. Mitty went to complain, all right, that I'm cyberbullying him. I showed the police the judgment. I said, where am I cyberbullying this man when the judgment is here? Now, how do you reach out to President Hakainde Hichilema when the people surrounding his presidency are those that we are questioning their moral fiber to save in the new Don government? The other challenge I put up today in my press briefing was that we've got the Minister of Home Affairs, the department, Immigration Department. They are saying they want to revoke 17,000 work permits. How can you revoke 17,000 work permits when you are the ones that issued those permits? Does it make any sense? You issue a permit and you are the same one to revoke it. If they're revoking one permit, two permits, it's reasonable. 17,000 is ridiculous. No, my thinking, which I am convinced beyond any doubt, is that the officers have been involved in doing a lot of illegalities before, and they want to continue doing the same wrong things like they did in the previous regime. If the government is really genuine to fighting corruption, what they need to do is to stop those revocations so that we do an audit as a country. How are these permits issued? And investigate those erring officers, because you cannot allow them to revoke the permits. Then they're destroying evidence.
Why do you think they are destroying evidence? Do you have any evidence to that effect?
For me, it's circumstantial evidence, because why would you revoke 17,000 permits 2 months after there is change of government? There's something wrong. And same people that issued the permits are the ones revoking them.
You are an independent, so you speak up your mind.
Yes.
But what do you think is the best course of action for President Hakainde Hichilema to take in order for you to be satisfied that indeed he's fighting the corruption that he promised or that Zambians expect from him?
We need to do an overhaul of the whole institution. The people that are mandated to fight corruption do not have the capacity to do so. Most of them are compromised. I have been a victim of the anti-corruption commission in this country under the previous regime. I went to report some Chinese national sometime last year. Before I could even sit in my vehicle, that Chinese called me to say, you are leaving the SEC. SEC reporting an informant to a suspect.
Munir Zulu is a Zambian independent parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In the the U.S., activists from the Gambia in the Washington, D.C. area have welcomed as a positive development a court ruling that they say forms part of the effort to hold former President Yahya Jammeh accountable for his rule. This after a court ruling allowed the U.S. government to seize a mansion belonging to the former president. The estimated $3.5 million estate, situated in the affluent Potomac, Maryland neighborhood just outside Washington, D.C., is a six-bedroom, nine-bathroom residence of the former president. The activists say there's proof that the former president used public funds to purchase the mansion for his pleasure, which they say should have been used to build hospitals and schools to help the poor in the West African country. Coach Pa Sambajao is a leading Gambian political activist in the Washington, D.C. area. He is also a leading member of a group of activists that had called on the U.S. government to confiscate the home. He tells me that the court ruling appears to be the first step in holding former President Jammeh accountable for his actions.
I'm very happy that finally justice is served, because I believe that Jammeh pillaged the meager resources of our country to buy that mansion for $3.5 million.
What importance do the people of the Gambia back home attach to this? Is there any significance at all?
Well, there is tremendous significance, because if you look at Africa today, not Gambia only in particular, but Africa in general, we've had leaders who came from nothing, from absolute poverty, came to power, promised that they would fight corruption and end up being absolutely corrupt. If you look at the $3.5 million that Jammeh spent in 2010, to buy this residence, you look at it at today's value, it's about $175 million that could have been utilized to help our hospitals. Today, if you look at the Gambia, we have a very high infant mortality rate, or even people dying from childbirth. The most basic things that our people need, they are being denied those things because of some leaders like Yahya Jammeh and the corrupt few decided, you know what, they would utilize the money for their own selfish interests rather than the people. So to me and to many Gambians, this is a sense of justice.
After this mansion has been seized, what's next for you as an activist?
First, we are going to continue looking at anywhere and everywhere that Jammeh has something, because it has to be seized. They have to be seized, whatever it is and wherever it is. But also, most importantly, we will work with the United States government to make sure that the residence, which is now valued at over $4 million, will be sold, and the money will be giving back to the poor people. It doesn't need to be given back to a politician who may end up lining his pocket, but at least some project that would directly affect the lives of the poor Gambian people would be done. So the struggle for justice against Jammeh, whether it is his tyranny or his corruption, continues unabated.
I'm sure you are aware that his party has joined forces with incumbent President Adama Barrow. There are suggestions that perhaps if President Barrow wins re-election, he could pardon former President Jammeh, and that could pave way for his return to the Gambia. Are there any concerns about the alliance?
Well, it is concerned, but disappointing. If you look at it today, Yahya Jammeh is still the supreme leader of the APRC. That's what they call him. So an alliance with the APR is an alliance with Yahya Jammeh. So what President Barrow has demonstratively shown to Gambians is that he cannot be trusted. It is true that Adama Barrow might try to pardon President Jammeh, but that would not save Jammeh. Jammeh's crimes are not only local, they are international. Lest we forget, the same Yahya Jammeh killed two American citizens, Ibu Diop and Alhaji Mamosise. The same Yahya Jammeh murdered or gave orders for the murder of almost 51 West Africans, 48 of whom were Ghanaians. So these are all countries that are interested in justice. So Jammeh cannot be shielded.
Have you bothered to ask what will be done with this mansion?
No, we've been talking to them because we've been in contact with the U.S. government, U.S. officials on this issue. And there is a process that must be followed. Like I said, we are not going to rest. We're going to continue those conversations, those engagements, to make sure that the money goes back to the Gambia. It does not belong to the United States. It belongs to the Gambian people. It was stolen from the Gambian treasury, and it must be returned to the Gambian treasury. But I know the United States is always very careful when it comes to this. They don't want to just take it and give it to back to another government that may do the same thing. But chances are, from our discussions and what we understand is that they may use it in form of a project where that will be to the amount of the money that was recovered to be given back to people. But be rest assured that we're going to continue this engagement to make sure that every penny of that looted residence is returned back to the Gambian people and to the deserving poor Gambian.
Coach Pasam Bajou is a leading Gambian political activist. He spoke with me from here in Washington. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, police in Nigeria's Zamfara state say security forces have rescued nearly 200 people who were abducted by criminal gangs over the last 2 months. The rescues are welcome news amid a wave of kidnappings for ransom in Nigeria's north. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Zamfara State Police Command spokesperson Shehu Mohammed said in a statement Thursday that police had rescued 187 people. He said the kidnapped victims, including women and children, were abducted many weeks ago from four different communities in the state. The spokesperson did not explain how the rescues took place, but said the kidnapped victims were freed from Sibiri Forest, where the kidnappers were holding them. Security forces in Zamfara began a manhunt several months ago to address the spate of kidnappings in the state. Teams often organize searches in forest hideouts. Their operations led to the shutdown of telecommunication services and introduction of curfews and movement restrictions, especially on motorcycles in September. Authorities say the restrictions cut off food supplies for the bandits and made it difficult for them to operate. Mohammed was not immediately available for comment, but security analyst Ebenezer Oyetakin agrees the restrictions paid off.
Whatever is necessary in order to contain the flame of violence that is plaguing the northwest state of Zamfara and Sokoto state is welcoming. We can see the results since the pragmatic move to shut down the telecommunications system in those areas. It is a very beautiful and heartwarming.
Authorities say the victims will receive medical treatment before reuniting with their families. Zamfara State in northwest Nigeria is one of the epicenters of a kidnap for ransom trend by criminal gangs that gained momentum late last year. Authorities in nearby states like Kaduna and Sokoto say the crackdown in Zamfara is driving bandits elsewhere and escalating security problems there. But Kaduna-based public analyst and community leader Abu Muhammad says Kaduna state authorities are also taking action.
We have predicted that their source of movement is through the cattle route, and they have been following the cattle route, following the grazing reserve, and following the national parks in their hideout. And they have also dictated other black spots within the state. So they are trying to comb all these insurgents, all these bad eggs out, and I believe they are doing that.
More than 1,200 people have been taken in mass abductions from schools and villages in northern Nigeria since last December. In response to pressure from authorities, gangs have grown fierce, attacking police formations and military bases to prevent rescue operations. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Catholic priests from the Jesuit Refugee Services, or JRS, are in the U.S. to meet with students and members of the church to discuss their work in the Middle East and North Africa. Father Dan Kuru, Regional Director for JRS in the Middle East and North Africa, and Father Joseph Kassar, Country Director of JSR in Iraq, share their experience and also talk about how their work is protecting people, including religious minorities forced to flee their homes. The Jesuit Refugee Services provides emergency assistance, adult education, psychosocial support, and advocacy for refugee rights. Analysts say assistance to international refugee group agencies significantly increased due to a recent surge in conflicts and the impact of the global coronavirus pandemic. To learn more about the work the Jesuit Refugee Services is doing in the Middle East and North Africa, I reached via Skype Father Dan Kuru, Regional Director for JRS in the Middle East and North Africa, and Father Joe Kassar, Country Director in Iraq.
So we are part of the Jesuit Refugee Services, and we're based in the Middle East. I'm in Beirut, and Father Joe is in Iraq, in Erbil. And so our initial is in desire is really just to meet with the JRS folks here in Washington to strengthen those ties. But I think also what I'm very aware of is, as we've seen, well, our region is not Afghanistan, Central Asia. What we're very aware of is the pressing need of refugees and displaced people throughout the world, and the imperative role that the United States plays in the very foundations of those issues, both through economic, military, and climate-influenced migration patterns. And we want to be here to really share, as an American myself, I want to share from the voices of the Syrians and Iraqis and Lebanese and Jordanians that we accompany, what are the pressing issues that Americans need to be aware of about migration, about displacement, about refugee issues in the Middle East.
What has been the cooperation between your institution and the American institution in terms of your objective of trying to help those who need assistance, particularly the refugees?
So JRS, our particular areas of focus are in education, mental health and psychosocial, community building and reconciliation work. And so we have schools for refugee and displaced children throughout the region, in all four of the countries where we work, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. And around each of those schools, there is a community center that would deal with mostly education and community building for the adults associated with those children. And so in each of those community centers, there is a mental health program, some that are highly specialized where we have psychologists and access to psychiatrists, but all of them with social workers and community support, basic support groups and things like that.
I'm sure your work is cut out for you, particularly with the surge of refugees and displaced persons all over the world.
That's correct. Yes, it's an incredibly difficult but very life-giving work.
For a refugee who is troubled in this time, particularly with the global coronavirus pandemic pretty much affecting everybody around the world, what assurances do you give them when you get to meet some of these refugees?
Do you want to talk about the Iraq circumstances?
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to give assurances to anybody who is a refugee in any case, even without the coronavirus. The only problem is that the coronavirus pandemic has made the situation worse for many people who are forcibly displaced, and therefore we are even in a lesser position to give any kind of assurance. Rather than assurances, I would say we try to keep people's hope alive, that they can overcome difficulties, that they can, first of all, look after themselves in such a way as to remain psychologically, mentally healthy, to continue to face the daily problems that they have to face, which are definitely not easy. So really, first and foremost, to be able to look after oneself and to maintain one's own mental health. Beyond that also, to always be on the lookout for those who are in the same situation so that people can support each other. In situations of distress, people can either become very oriented towards helping one another or close in on themselves and rather seeking survival. We would rather choose the first mode, where people are encouraged to, even in the midst of many problems which they face, to continue to think of others who may need their help and support, so that together we may make it.
Father Dan Kuru is Regional Director for JRS in the Middle East and North Africa, and Father Joe Kassar is Country Director in Iraq. They spoke with me from here in Washington. Refugee and humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and Ethiopia were the focus of intense debate during this week's annual United Nations Refugee Conference. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says the week-long discussions were constructive. He says there was general agreement on the need for urgent, flexible, and unconditional aid to be delivered to millions of internally displaced Afghans through humanitarian agencies. He says this is doable, but he says the delivery of food, shelter, and other essential relief supplies must be done quickly before the onset of winter. He says the Taliban will not impede these operations from going ahead. Grandi notes, since the Taliban takeover, Afghan society has been barely functioning. He warns this could lead to an even bigger humanitarian crisis unless the international community steps in to prevent a complete meltdown of the country's services, banking, and economic systems.
It is extremely difficult because much of this economy services functioned in Afghanistan before, thanks to international support that now has been frozen or suspended. So the question is how to ensure that these services and the economy can function, and how can we prevent a major humanitarian crisis.
Grandi says Ethiopia is the second crisis that commanded a lot of attention at the conference. He says delegates expressed great concern about the recent expulsion from the country of senior United Nations officials by the Ethiopian government. He says the delegates worried about the limited ability to provide aid to millions of civilians trapped in Tigray and about the conflict spreading to other regions in northern Ethiopia.
And of course, the appeal is always the same. Abandon this useless and devastating approach, which is military approach, and go for a negotiated process. That's the only way to stop the escalation of humanitarian needs in the country.
The UN reports around 5.2 million people, or 90% of Tigray's population, needs humanitarian aid. While most attention was focused on Afghanistan and Ethiopia, High Commissioner Grandi says he appealed to states at the meeting to not forget the other refugee crises, noting they exist in every region of the world. They include the Rohingya in Southeast Asia, West Africa's Sahel region, Syria in the Middle East, and Venezuela in Central America. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Did he see you? on Insta. Sexy with delicious twister.
me teaching reason. I'll make you fall in love, I'm a thief in the heart. To me, it's an art. Baby, your eyes don't lie. I can see you want a little bit of me when you laugh. I can treat you like the princess you are, but behind closed doors, we can do it all. Ladies first, when I open doors, I got an open mind, let me open yours. You can come see me while I'm on tour, but till then, besito mi amor. Watching you, watching me, yeah. And I'll give you what's wrong, right? Watching you, watching me, watching you, watching me, yeah. And I'll give you what you want, right?
Nikuite papa, Nanita mama, nikwite papa. Nanita mama, nikwite papa. Nikwite papa, nanita mama.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you have no teeth, do not break the clay cooking pot. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.